and welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I am bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today, someone who changed my life through this genre, and I'm sure many, many other people out there, in celebration of his new ecstatic piece imprint on Omnibus Press, Thurston fucking Moore of the band Sonic Youth, of Thurston Moore solo, of the Coachman, of Society's Ill, of I think he played with Gigi Allen for one show too. Anyway, more on that in a second. This is a huge episode, everyone. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can head over to turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com and write an email that will go to my brother, Tristan Abraham, who is the show producer, also the runner of various other Turned Out a Punk social media platforms, I guess, for lack of a better word. There's an Instagram page, there's a Facebook page. You can follow all of that at Turned Out a Punk or /Turned Out a Punk or whatever you have to do. But you can write an email, though, at turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. There is also finding me on social media at Left for Damien. That's another way to get in touch with the show. The best way to support the show is by telling all your friends, everyone you know, rating it, writing a review for it on your podcast platform of choice. And speaking of support, this show would not be possible without the kind, loving, generous support of the fine folks at Vans, who said, "We don't want you to do this out of your pocket anymore, Damien. We just want you to do your show. Pick who you want to get the guests you want to get." So I thank him for that. Thank you, Vans. And that's it. On to today's show. Today on the show, Thurston Moore from the band Sonic Youth. Now, I've never really gone into my whole detailed journey on this podcast, but the band that was really the one that got it all going for me was Sonic Youth. I met a kid named Nick who was a huge Sonic Youth fan, hit me to Sonic Youth, and it was off to the races from there. I didn't even like Nirvana at the time. I got into Nirvana through Sonic Youth. That was, and it wasn't because I was like so early to it. It was because I didn't get Nirvana, but Sonic Youth I got. And Sonic Youth was a gateway for me, you know, through hardcore. They covered Nick Fit. They covered Crime. They were like a utility knife for me, you know, and understanding this whole new world that I was kind of obsessed with. And now, all these years later, to sit down and talk to Thurston Moore. Now, I've run into Thurston Moore a couple times over the years. Some were better than others. We will go into all that, I think, in future episodes. But one thing that has always remained is the fact that I've looked up to this guy as a record collector, as someone who made music. And, you know, you forget sometimes that this guy was also there at Ground Zero for punk rock and really got to see the whole evolution in the epicenter for it, like New York City. He's watching hardcore happen. He's watching no wave happen. And of course, he's watching punk happen. So to have him here and to get to punish him, oh, that is a big prize for me. But I once again have to say a huge thank you to Matthew O'Donohue over at Omnibus Press, where Thurston Moore has now started this ecstatic piece library imprint. They put out a bunch of stuff so far, including a Thurston Moore book, which I'm working my way through. Don't worry, so far there's not a lot of conflicts in the information in this podcast and this book. You know, this podcast tends to go to the nerdier side of everything. They've also put out, though, the Death Archives, which is an incredible book of the Mayhem Archives from 84 to 94. Necro Butcher was involved in that. Thurston Moore wrote the afterword for it. And they've also put out this fantastic, like, exact replica reissue of Tony D's infamous, famous, incredible Ripped and Torn fanzine, which is one of the first Scottish punk fanzines ever. You know, 77, I think they could start, 78. This book, 77. This book is incredible, though. It's the exact repros. This is, you know, it shows you, like, this is being done by people that collect records and zines and books and are general nerds, you know? And I think you will hear that on this podcast. So on to the show today. This is a good one. We get into some nerdy territory. This is a huge thrill for me to get to do. As you can hear it in my voice, I'm pretty excited about this podcast. And I've been really excited for everyone to get to hear it. There will be, of course, you know, hopefully other parts in the future. But anyway, I do have a note. At one point in the podcast, Thurston had to jump off the call, comes back on the call, and we are talking about Jonah. So when you're thrust into that conversation about Jonah, you know, Jonah from Fucked Up Career Suicide, it's someone you got to talk about. And so I could have edited that out, but I decided to leave that in, that conversation about Jonah, and why he rules, because he does rule. And Thurston knows that too. And I think that's it for notes. There's a little bit of audio stuff towards the end, but sure, you can get through it. This is a good one. I'm not going to blather on anymore. Everyone, please sit back, relax, and enjoy Thurston Moore on Turned Out a Punk. Thurston, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're more than welcome, Damien.
Well, as I was just telling you off the air, normally this is said, it's all for you, Damien, but it's all for you, Thurston. This whole thing, I feel, has been building up to you coming on this show in some way.
Oh, right on, man. I've been looking forward to it.
Well, that is a big thrill to hear, because I can tell you that you're the guy that got me into this whole thing. So I've been waiting a long time to ask you a lot of these questions. but I got to start them off the way I start them all off, which is, Thurston, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Man, I feel like I was always into punk. You know, in the early 70s, I really responded to like weirdo outsider rock and roll. I mean, I loved all kinds of rock and roll music. I had an older brother, you know, I still do have an older brother. He's 5 years older. But he was bringing in, you know, like the heavy 60s stuff into the house, Hendrix and Beatles and Cream and whatever. And I, you know, it was just like really part of our environment was rock and roll. And his hippie friends coming in and introducing Jefferson Airplane and all this, whatever, and all this kind of stuff. But I started really responding pretty quickly to things that were more raw and primal and kind of just from the margins. You know, the first record that came into our house in 64 around, with my brother, brought in the first rock and roll record in our house was Louie Louie by the Kingsmen. And then in a way, Louie Louie is kind of like, by the Kingsmen, it's kind of like the text of punk in a way. It was like,
absolutely,
kind of like, you know, it was like these Pacific Northwest teens. Well, they weren't probably teens. They're probably in their early 20s, but making like this really sort of like super immediate kind of record that was just all about, like, you know, standing on the corner smoking cigs and like, you know, looking for action. Mm-hmm. And that was just kind of, you know, but at the same time, kind of bored. And just in hearing the mistake in that record, you know, when the singer sort of comes in and then sort of stops and they leave it in the, they leave it on the record. All these things, like, you know, to me were just like totally beautiful.
Yeah.
So that was the beginning. But, you know, but later on into the early 70s, you know, I was born in 58, so I'm 10 and 68, and I'm sort of like getting, you know, I'm like 13, 14, early 70s. Mm-hmm. I'm very curious about David Bowie when I start seeing pictures of that. Like, what is that? Like, who's that guy? I'm very interested in Captain Beefheart. Like, what's going on there? And the thing is, it's like, just buying all the magazines that you can find, like just not only Rolling Stone, which is like really heavy at that time, but Circus Magazine, Hit Parader Magazine, and then Rock Scene Magazine comes in out of New York, Cream coming out of Detroit. And when you can find these magazines, you know, we're just like, you know, would gobble them up. And that's when I started seeing images of things like Iggy, you know. And the first image I saw of Iggy was in a Cream magazine of him standing on the hands of the audience, pointing spray painted silver. I was like, what does that sound like? What could that be? Right. Same with Beefheart, like seeing a picture of Beefheart with his top hat and his goatee. And like, what does that guy sound like? The lucky thing about being in the USA at that time was like those records were super unpopular, and they would become cutouts, you know. Mm-hmm. They were discounted immediately, and they would end up in the Woolworths and the shopping mall stores for nothing, for like 49 cents, you know. That's what I remember. Like, so I would always, and I had no money, so I would look in the 49 cent bin. I'm not going to buy Abbey Road for like $3.99. I'm going to buy Captain Beefheart the Spotlight Kit for 49 cents. And that's what I always remember. Where I got my education was like these records that nobody wanted, that, you know, that couldn't sell. And a lot of them were bunk, but then there would be things like, you know, Cannes Egg Bamyasi that United Arts put out, like, or, you know, the Amon Duel 2 record that you would find for 49 cents, and the First Stooges record. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing the First Stooges record, like, in multiple, like, in, like, a Woolworths, you know, with the corner cut off and, like, 49 cents. Nobody wants this thing. This is, like, you know, this is just utter trash.
It was that of a success when it came out, I guess.
Yeah. And so this is like 71, 72. And I was like, I'm going to, you know, and I used to look at the cover thinking like, man, what is up with these guys? You know, yeah. Like just the way they look, you know, that look on their face, you know, just like, and so I had processed, you know, some of these records, Beefheart and Can, and they were just like weirdo records, but they were my records and I liked them. And I knew that they were kind of super odd and, you know, but they were really formative for my, you know, whatever music that I would eventually make. But the Stooges record, which I was very curious about, and I get it home and I remember playing it and thinking like, this is so monodynamic. I mean, it's just like, it was completely like, you know, submental in a way, you know, and I just like, couldn't, I was like, wow. Like, you know, I was like, and you know, when you get to the end of side one and they do, we will fall for like 10 minutes, you know, and just like, what is, you know, what is that all about? And there's something so spooky and something raw. And it's like those lyrics were just not, they were not flowery pop rock lyrics. You know, these lyrics about like, you know, being not right and like little doll, I can't forget standing with your cigarette, smoking on your cigarette. And then like, you know, these, nobody talk about cigarettes in music except for the Stooges, you know. It's like, wow, he's singing about cigarettes. Sometimes he's singing about a girl smoking a cigarette. That's like the coolest thing in the world. You know, like this is like, there's nothing more cool than like seeing a girl smoking a cigarette. You know, that was like, so I fell in love with these guys immediately. And I would try to sort of turn the few friends I had, you know, around town that were, I'd listen to records with onto these records. And they were just like, no, man, you know. It's like, this stuff sounds horrible, you know, you know, it was like, and they were really, you know, the thing is, you were supposed to be getting into Yes and Emerson, Lake and Palmer and, you know, these kind of sophisticated kind of bands. And I kind of understood that. And I remember like buying Yes songs that, you know, I was like, I'm going to go all the way here and buying Yes songs, you know, a triple album. You know, like, yes, like from beginning to end, like triple album. And I remember putting that on and thinking like, I really have no time for this. You know, This is like, you know, it's like Rick Wakeman had one whole side, you know, of keyboard, you know, soloing. And I would eventually just like take it off and like put the Stooges record back on. Like, yeah, this is more like, so that was like my introduction to punk, knowing that it was something that it was kind of, it was a friend, you know, it was like my, you know, this was like, you know, those records were like mine. And like, we kind of like, you know, I realized that I had to sort of figure out who else does this appeal to, you know? And the first gigs I went to were kind of these arena gigs and they were really disappointing. Funnily enough, the first gig I saw was Rick Wakeman, you know, like doing his like Journey to the Center of the Earth tour.
Yeah.
And I sat there because I just wanted to go to a concert. And I sat there with like my friend and his older brother who scored the tickets thinking like, and this is really kind of like boring, but it's more interesting just sort of looking around the arena at all the hippies like doing whatever they were doing, you know. And then I saw a few other things. I saw Zappa and then I saw Peter Frampton and Jake Isles band getting a little better. It wasn't until I saw Kiss in Springfield, Massachusetts, where I was like, that is how you're supposed to come out and kill on stage. You know, like these, they were just like, they were superb. You know, they just like really came out and just like, we're going to like blow your minds right now. And, but you know, I also knew that that was like sort of this kind of, you know, super rock and roll entertainment. I was way more into wanting to see the New York Dolls or something. I wanted to be like more like, you know, in the pit with like just the trashy rock, you know. And there was, before punk rock, you know, there was this thing in New York where they kind of referred to that street rock sound as street rock or like raunchy rock. There was a fanzine called Raunchy Rock, actually. You would see like Wayne County on the cover or the Dolls on the cover. I have one copy of it. I always like to find more copies of Raunchy Rock.
What else would they, because obviously would it be like the Fast or like what mm-hmm. that was, I guess
that's the Fast were definitely part of that.
Yeah.
And the Fast are like one of the most important bands in the New York scene.
Such a great sure. band.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that was like one of the first bands I started seeing regularly in New York was the Fast. It took me a while to get into the city because I was, you know, as soon as I got my driver's license, I found one friend in high school who came up to me and said, like, Patti Smith's playing at in Westport, Connecticut, you know, tonight. And I was like, he's like, let's go. And I was just like, and I hardly knew this kid. I could tell he was kind of like, I would see him in school. And I knew that he was kind of hip to like things like Roxy music and stuff like this. And so we commandeered a car from some other kid I knew. And we said, they'd take us to Westport, which is like an hour away. And we just like whipped over there and we got tickets and we went in and we saw Patti Smith, like it was like late 75 or something. And it was totally like great. You know, it was just like, she came out and like leather jacket coming out and starting with like, you know, we're going to have a real good time together by the Velvet Underground, you know, just like, you know, just total garage rock kind of like in, great. And, you know, super androgynous, you know, and, so we knew we were on the right track. And then the Ramones would play in Connecticut too. So we, you know, I missed the Ramones played nearby at a high school, which I missed cause I didn't know about it. And then they played this famous Ramones gig with Joey on drums opening for Johnny Winter at the, Waterbury, Palace, which I'd heard about.
Whoa, who like sang?
One of the first gigs outside of New York. I think, you know, the legend of that gig was like Joey played drums. I think Johnny was trying to sing. I think they probably played for all of 20 minutes. It's like in their gigography. Like it's like one of their first few gigs outside of New York. So somehow they got that on that bill. And which is too weird because I was really into Johnny Winter, Still Alive and Well, I thought was like a really just great rowdy record.
Yeah.
And if I was old enough, I would have been at that gig, but so I didn't see that.
It's funny
because I eventually saw them like, you know, in Connecticut because these guys would come to Connecticut to like do gigs that weren't far from New York City. So we got to see like David Johansen and you know, like after the Dolls broke up. And Talking Heads when they, you know, they came. And so it was a little easier for us before we actually got into the city to see like, you know, Dead Boys and Suicide and all this kind of stuff. But it came quickly after.
I was going to say Connecticut eventually gets a punk scene or like a, you know, or like a
I think it's a hardcore scene.
A hardcore scene, definitely. But there were some first wave stuff too, right? Like there were a couple.
I don't know what that would have been. I mean, I remember seeing some like kind of garage rock bands like early 70s, like the Boss Blues, who did like a 7-inch that's kind of collectible for garage rock aficionados.
I was trying to think of this.
I remember seeing them as a kid and thinking like they were cool because they were like chewing bubble gum while they were playing and stuff.
Trying to think of the Kill by Death, Bloodstains Across Connecticut, if there is one or anything like that.
I mean, you know, I think there's some stuff that starts happening like right after I leave. I mean, I moved to New York in springtime in like 76, and I would come back with my guitar on the train. It was like an hour and a half train ride. And the kids I knew in high school would be hanging out by the train station near the like the Friendlies there or something. Mm-hmm. And they'd see me get off this train with my guitar and they would just be looking at me like, what are you doing? Like, what do you think you're doing? You know? And some of them would be like, yeah, you know, it's like, well, I was, you know, like, oh, you're not good enough to, you know, hang out with us Friendlies.
You got bigger plans. You got to go to New York City. Well, and also there's that famous story. I think this is in one of the Sonic Youth books. When you go to New York City, I think for the first time, and you actually see Joey Ramone walking down the street and you ask him how to get to CBGB's, right?
Yeah, yeah. We would go in to see we were into the Fast. The Fast would play a lot and then my friend Harold who I was very close to, who hit me to the Patti Smith thing. We just became really connected. Mm-hmm. And then so he was really open to like what I was into. And I was like, "Dude, you got to check this out." And then so all of the glam thing, like just whatever. And then like anything that was like new in the punk thing was happening. And we would drive to this great record store in New Haven, Connecticut called Cutler's. And there was a singles department. And I remember walking in there one of the first times because I wanted to get, you know, Blondie's X Offenders 7-inch, which I had heard about. And that was like one of the first 7-inches on the New York scene. And
absolutely.
Asking the guy, like, do you have a record by this group called Blondie? And he looked at me because he kind of knew what I was talking about. He says, "Are you kidding me?" And then he's like, "Yeah, you know, like nobody would ever ask for this thing." And so there was a singles department, and that guy was getting imports, and that's where we would go. And that's where I got like Slaughter and the Dogs, which was like the first sort of record from England that I could hear. Mm-hmm. And then there was the Buzzcocks Spiral Scratch. Well, there was New Rose and the Buzzcocks Spiral Scratch. So those were the first big three. And then like Anarchy 7-inch. But so that stuff was just like, whoa. Each time was just like just playing that stuff over and over again. So we would go almost like, you know, twice a week to Cutler's. But then, you know, New York was a little more dangerous and a little more expensive, you know. But the first time we went, you know, we went to Max's just to go. We went there like at 6 p.m. and like, you know, things don't start until like 11. And so we just like, we were like sitting there like drinking Cokes and like, just like, wow, when's the music start? You know, and like finally are like around 11 o'clock, the guy behind the bar was just like, "What are you guys doing?" I was like, "Well, we're waiting for the bands." You know, like he's like, "No, it's upstairs, you idiots." And, you know, like, oh. And so we like went upstairs and that's where we saw The Fast and The Planets. And Suicide.
What an awesome first show.
Yeah. Super, just like we didn't even speak to each other on the way home. Yeah. You know, we're just like, it was one of those things where like, what just happened? It was like, yeah, the back of your heads were just like splattered. So we did, but we did know one thing, that we were going to go back. And so we started, that was the beginning of the whole New York thing. And I had heard about this new place called On the Rocks. Mm-hmm. And it was a very short-lived thing, and it was like there was a picture in Roxine magazine of like David Johansen and you know, like Tommy Ramone, and like they were hammering nails into this like stage, like, "Oh, our new club On the Rocks." I was like, "Yeah, we got to go there." And we went there and saw Wayne County and the Backstreet Boys, and Joey was there, and Ramones had just come back from their first foray in England. And so I really wanted to like ask him about that.
Yeah.
And so there was a couple of dudes standing around Joey talking to him, because, you know, he was just like, he was the guy, you know, he was like 6'7", you know, just hunched over. And just like, he just represented everything for me. Like what was so cool about punk rock, because it was like, this was not some posturing rock god kind of like money person. This was like this guy from like suburbs who was, you know, probably pushed up against a locker all his life, standing there like, you know, singing in like this amazing band that like people still had to get their heads around. And so I went up to him and just, you know, I just sort of asked him about like the Sex Pistols he's like, yeah, they're okay, you know. He goes, yeah. But he was like, he said, yeah, they're all right, you know, but, you know, Wayne County and the Backstreet Boys, they're like, nobody beats them, man. They're the best.
That's awesome.
And I was like, he was kind of right, because Wayne's band was like super good.
Is that the band that played on that Max's Kansas City single?
Yeah.
That single's awesome. Holy, yeah.
Yeah, totally awesome. And on the Max's those tracks on the Max's album. But so we got back in my Volkswagen and we were going to sort of, you know, head back to Connecticut, and I saw Joey and his friend walking down the street, and I was like, man, I really want to go to CBGB. Like we had been to Max's, we went to this place on the Rocks. And we went to the Palladium and saw like, you know, some bigger thing. But I had yet to go to CBGB, and I really wanted to go there. Yeah. And like, I just couldn't figure out like we were just kids. I was like, how do you even get there? Like it's around here somewhere. And like, and just seeing pictures of it, like in Roxy and stuff, I was like, man, that's really like, you know, that's the Nirvana. We got to go there. And so I knew it was like on the Bowery and Bleecker, and we were on Bleecker, and I was like, if maybe we should just keep driving on Bleecker, we'll see it, you know, like. But what we did see was we saw Joey walking with some friend of his, and he was kind of inebriated. I could tell he was like, he was kind of swerving. And I rolled down the window. I said, "Hey, you know, hey Joey, like, you know, blah blah. Where's CBGB?" And he was like, pointed straight ahead. Like, "Hey, it's this way, man." And I said, "Cool." And I said, "Hey, you want a ride? You want to, you know, give you a ride there?" He's like, Yeah. And he started coming over to the car, and his friend just reached over and grabbed him by the heart and said, hey, don't get in that car. You know, he's like, don't get in some guy's car. You know, like, I could tell that was what was going on. Like, you know, just jump in somebody's car in New York City. You know,
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Especially in 1976.
Especially in that neighborhood in 1976.
Yeah, like, yeah, totally. Totally.
What was that?
It was like, you know, it was like the city was bankrupt, and there was a lot of, like, there was street crime, and, you know, you just had to be careful. You know, there's a lot of desperate people bombing around the Lower East Side. And, you know, but we went there. We just parked. We parked, and we went inside, and it was like $3. I don't think we had the money, and, like, you know, and $3 was a lot. Usually it was like $1.50 to get in these places, or two. The $3 was just sort of like, well, that's kind of extravagant. And so I remember standing there, like, but there it was, you know, there was, you know, we were inside, and that place was like on the Bowery with all these, like, flop houses and, you know, sirens and whatever. And the homeless guys just sort of like, you know, lying around with their bottles and, you know, and, just being in this place, I was just like, it was like walking into like a witch's gingerbread house or something. It was stucco walls and, like, these wooden, like, you know, window protectors and a wooden door that just completely creaked when you open it, you know? So it was like really going into like an old witch's house or something.
Yeah.
And, so walking in there, realized not having money, and there's Richard Hell standing right there. And I was just like all about Richard Hell. I had seen Richard Hell in the Voidoids at, Max's. And I was just like, to me, Richard Hell was just like, he was the guy.
Yeah.
Along with Joey and, you know, whatever, and Patty. But so he's standing there. He's also inebriated. And I'm just sort of like, and in a, I asked him, I said, like, can you get us in here? He's like, oh, man, you know. And then he had a stamp on his hand, you know, that from the door.
Yeah.
And he started licking the stamp on his hand and trying to rub it on my hand, like one of those deals, which wasn't working at all. And but we kind of snuck in somehow. We kind of just, like, went in, you know. It was kind of chaotic. And Blondie was on stage, and the Mumps were headlining, and that's what was going on. And I just remember walking, like, past the bar, and as soon as we were walking past the bar, like, a beer bottle went flying by my face and, like, smashed in behind the bar. And I was like, what the, like, is this really what I'm, where am I, you know, what am I getting into here? And, like, this is, like, really intense.
Your life is what that TV show Vinyl should have been, Thurston.
But, you know, the thing is, that incident, like, that never happened again in my life. That only happened, like, when I first walked in there, like a bottle flying by my face and smashing. And, like, that kind of, like, so-called punk violence or whatever, that never happened again in my life at CBGB's. But it happened that first time. So it was weird. Blondie was incredible. And CBGB's at that point, like, had tables and chairs, and they had a kitchen making, like, really suspect hamburgers, and then there's dogs and cats, you know. It was like this kind of weird place, but it was very homey, you know.
What were the Mumps like? Because
Mumps were great. They were like,
I love that
Christian Hoffman and Lance Loud.
Yeah,
you know, it was like this kind of thing, like, these punk bands were still coming out of, like, this kind of New York City kind of post Warhol kind of cabaret glammy thing, a glitter thing, you know? And so, like, the bass player would always sort of be like, same with Blondie, like Gary Valentine as the bass player, and the Mumps, I forget the bass player's name, but they had this kind of thing where the hair had to be sort of like, sort of curly and, like, you know, like, kind of a curly fro, and then you were kind of like kind of dressed up, you know, almost like Sylvain with, like, kind of the big rouge on his cheek, and you're kind of like, you're kind of a bit of a toy doll, like, bass player, like, kicking your sneakers up in the air. It was like this milk and cookies kind of thing, you know, like, you know, we're just kind of young and innocent, but, man, we have lots of sex and we get high all the time.
Speaking of milk and cookies, did you ever see Milk and Cookies?
No, I wish I did, because I actually did liner notes for the box set.
That, you know. What a great box set.
Yeah. But I had the Milk and Cookies import record, which came out like 2 years after their demise kind of thing. But I was kind of fascinated by them. I knew they were sort of part of that kind of that transitional era in New York from like kind of glitter to punk.
Yeah.
And they were really important, but they were just so weird, you know, mm-hmm. the way that guy sang, you know, like in that kind of like faux, you know, little lost boy voice, you know, but the songs were cool. And, yeah, I never saw them, you know, it's funny. I saw them around. They were, you know, you'd see these guys at gigs. You knew who the people who were in bands and who weren't, you know, like at the clubs. And they were kind of older. I was a young guy. I was like, you know, I was 18. Yeah. A lot of people living in New York in bands were like, you know, 21, 22. I mean, Blondie was like already, and Patty, those two women were already closing in on 30. You mm-hmm. know? And so mm-hmm. there was kind of like this interesting sort of like age difference between like the new kids like me coming in and sort of like just observing, you know, and, yeah. and being in the audience. And like, so the first teenage bands, there weren't any bands that were like 18, 19 years old until like just at the end of the 70s.
Just
like
before we move on from the
Stimulators were the first in a way.
Oh, sorry. Just before we move on, I definitely want to talk about all that stuff too. But I just want to talk about the Mumps for one quick second. Like, when you saw them, were you already familiar with the Mumps, or were you like, oh my God, that's that guy from that TV show?
Yeah. I was familiar with the Mumps only because I kept close tabs on Lance Loud because I was a huge fan of An American Family.
Yeah.
Which was like a PBS, like cinema verite show, way ahead of its time as far mm-hmm. as like reality TV. Where they, the cameras lived with this all-American family. And it just happened to be the Loud family, you know, that was like an upper middle class kind of West Coast family. And Lance was the radical son. He was like gay, kind of moved to New York, lived in the Chelsea Hotel and kind of flaunced around with the world crowd. And so he was like really interesting. And then in that show, American Family, he has a band where he covers Kink songs and Stone songs and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then knowing that he had this band, the Mumps, playing around the CBGB's Maxis scene was very, very curious to see. And they were great because I didn't really expect them to be as good as they were. I mean, when they came out on stage, he came out, he was like wild. He danced like a dervish. Like he was just like sort of like a cross between a dervish and a gorilla. He was like really kind of big and he would just like do this total monkey dance and like, you know, and just like whip around the stage and just like, he was really like super entertainer, you know? Mm-hmm. And, so it was like really fun to watch that band and all, you know, the songs were really kind of like kooky and fun and like, you know, and, so yeah. And then they put out that 7-inch. The 7-inch is, you know, like lots of bands' records, first records, where they just kind of catch how great they are live, you mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. you know, because they're like, it's compressed in the studio environment. So it's just like, well, there's the song, you know, but it's just like live. It's like this explosion, you know, it's like, it's just a lot, you know, it's just the way it is.
There was a cool reissue that Sympathy did, I don't know, maybe 12 years ago now, 18 years ago now, that was like, that had a DVD CD-ROM type thing on a second disc that had all this great footage of them, like a live TV special even, I think, or something.
Of the Mumps,
yeah. It was like...
Of the Mumps.
Yeah, it was like definitely something shot, maybe it was in a live TV special, but it certainly was like a... It's shot in front of a studio backdrop type thing. And it was...
Oh, I have to check that out.
It was awesome.
So wait, Sympathy did like a Mumps like compilation or something?
Yeah, like a double CD compilation. Remember there's one from the 80s that I think is like... That's one CD. And then there was like a double CD that Sympathy did that was a reissue of that one. Or like the early 90s, I guess that first CD came out.
I'll have to check that out. I'll check that out.
But yeah, like I was now... Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off earlier because I definitely want to talk about this. Like, were you seeing like Harley Flanagan and the other people from the Stimulators kind of around, like other younger kids that were also taking it in like yourselves?
Yeah, there was a coterie of like young kids who actually lived in New York and mm-hmm. they were like CBGBs every night kind of kids, like sitting in the front. And, you know, when the Dead Boys came to town, you know, they became like super central to like what these kids wanted. And it was definitely – I don't remember Harley so much, even though Harley was around a bit. But I remember seeing Harley around, especially like when the Stimulators would play, I was like, well, this, you know, it's like this 2-year-old kid on drums. Yeah. You know? But it's like, you know, but I knew that he was like, he had a poetry book, you know, he wrote like as a little kid, and yeah. Allen Ginsberg wrote the foreword to it. And I was kind of aware of that because I was kind of aware of Ginsberg. Ginsberg used to hang out at CBGB's and he would like unabashedly take the stage with like Peter Orlovsky, and they would like play like, you know, accordions, and they would play this like chanting mantra kind of like, you know, like Buddhist kind of, and people would just sit there and go like, okay, you know, like what, you know, it's like, he's Ginsberg, what are you going to do?
He did a punk record later on, right? With the,
with the
Gluons?
Denver punk
band. Yeah.
The Gluons.
Yeah.
Well, that's because he was part of the Boulder, Naropa University poetry university scene. So the Denver, okay. Connection makes sense.
Definitely makes
sense. But yeah, Ginsberg, you know, I remember seeing Patty there, and Burroughs would come in and they would like, you know, clear a table for him. They'd push people out of their chairs. You know, just get out of, you know, Hilly, and like he have these like henchmen just come in and like just push people out of their chairs and then sit Burroughs and his crew like right there, like, you know, these untouchables,
the beat know, mafia
and Patty. Yeah And it's like all to see Patty, you know.
Wow.
But he so you would see like, in, you know, you would see like these kind of beat poet era people, Ann Waldman, Gregory Corso, like, you know, they would be coming in there and stuff. They would, that was kind of their neighborhood, you know, why shouldn't they? Mm-hmm. And this stuff was where it was at, you know. And Patty was like sort of like the grand dame of it all. So she was super connected to that scene. And so it just made sense. You know, and Richard Hell was reading at Poetry Project. Tom Verlaine was like, you know, publishing poetry. I mean, you know, there was a really definite connection to the kind of like poetry underground of like, you know, post Ginsberg Corso. And so they kind of felt like this was as much their territory as the punks were there, you know. And yeah, as far as being punks, nobody was really dressing punk like English punk or anything. It was just like, it was just kind of wild, you know. It was still kind of glittery in a way, but it was definitely skinny ties, getting rid of the flares, cutting your hair, you know, wearing sneakers, you know, getting your clothes from like the 99-cent bins in front of, you know, Canel jeans at the time when it was on Broadway.
Well, like you're saying, this is the transitional period.
Yeah.
What about the Steel Tips? Did you ever see the Steel Tips?
Yeah, Steel Tips were like one of my favorite bands. They came from New Jersey, but the Steel Tips were sick because like they actually played quite a bit. And the fact that the Steel Tips weren't really sort of like, you know, larger in the narrative of all the New York punk scene, it doesn't make sense. But
yeah,
because they played a lot. They only had like one, they never had a record that ever showed like how crazy and good they were. But they would come out, and the two lead singers, one was like a huge kind of like, you know, he looked like the prototypical guy, like hanging off the garbage truck, you know, like picking up cans and dumping them. And like he dressed that way, grease, like, you know, he had like slick back kind of gray hair and just kind of like, you know, like a wife beater t-shirt kind of stained. And like, you know, just had that look, you know, like a tattoo on his bicep that said mom, you know, like
he was like a biker too, right? Like,
yeah, kind of biker trash guy, but like trash man. And so he would come out, and next to him was like this young, young girl dressed up like in a Catholic school girl's outfit. It's so, it's just like really inappropriate kind of connection. And they kind of like sang these songs together, and he kind of shimmied and danced, and she kind of like, she danced, and it was like pretty hot. And you were just like, whoa, this is weird. And they had this other guy, I think of his name. He became quite a famous artist.
Joe Coleman.
Joe Coleman. And, but we didn't know who Joel Coleman was then. You know, I mean, he eventually would become quite known as an artist. And Joe Coleman came out. The first time I saw him, they come out and they're doing a song. And what really impressed me was not only just like the weirdness of that performance, was the guitar player guy who kind of obviously was sort of like the arranger, songwriter of the band. Mm-hmm. And he had a really cool guitar style. And I remember even I brought my brother with me, my older brother, and he was like a real sort of like technique guitar kind of a, you know, appreciation guy. And he was like, he always talked about that guitar player and Steel Tips. And when they came out, they're playing this song, and Joe Coleman sort of comes out, and he's completely wrapped up. And firecrackers, like strings of firecrackers. So it's like basic, you know, like cheapo firecrackers, but blocks of them wrapped around his body. And he comes sort of waddling out on stage, like wrapped up in all these fireworks. And he slowly takes out like a box of matches. And I hear my brother sitting next to me going like, oh no, like no, like he's not. And he lights the match, and he just blows up. I mean, it goes on for, and he's like, you know, like just totally like, you know, like spazzing out, like, you know, while these firecrackers just blowing up all over him, you know. It was just insane. It was just like so good. It was, you know, like, can you imagine doing that in a club now? It's like you would go to jail for life.
Absolutely. there's like one video of them playing. It's on, and once again, I think it's a Target video, but it's the footage of the Dead Boys that would eventually wind up in that New York documentary that has the Blondie, Ramones, and the Dead Boys footage.
Yeah, yeah.
And on the DVD reissue of that, there's like one song by the Steel Tips playing. Mm-hmm. And it's just, yeah, like you said, it's a real injustice that they're not brought up at all in the narrative of punk.
Well, they never really did the again, you know, like, it, there's a few bands from the Glitter era, like I had always heard about, but never heard. There was a band called Harlots of 42nd Street. And like, you would always see their picture associated with like all the other sort of glitter bands, be it the Dolls or Kiss or, and I say Kiss only because Kiss was there, but they kind of had their own world and became their own thing. But, you know, Wayne County Dolls and who else? Eric Emerson's band. But there was this one band called the Harlots of 42nd Street who were always sort of associated with that scene.
Okay.
Never heard anything. And, you know, the Bratz, you know, who eventually sort of like we got some records, reissues of them, but when the internet first started, there was I got a contact with the son of one of the Harlots of 42nd Street, and he said like, yeah, my dad has like these tapes like in the garage, you know, like, and I was just trying like, we've got to put this stuff out,
yeah,
we really want to hear the Harlots of 42nd Street. The what I had heard was like they were not a very good band, you know, who can really say that? I've never heard them. I mean, there's no recorded documentation of them. I think there's actually something on YouTube now where you can see some of the Harlots playing. I think there is, and it's a little hard to find because it's not under the Harlots of 42nd Street. It's like in some other, it's in some other weird broadcast thing.
Weird.
Where you can see it. And like, I remember like somebody sent me a link to it and I was like, oh, there they are, you know? and it's not exactly the greatest thing in the world, but it's just like, whoa, you know, there they are. And, so there's lots of things that never got documented that maybe it would have been interesting when you look in the history books. I mean, in Steel Tips, they had a 7-inch and then there was a 12-inch. And I remember being kind of very excited that they had a record, but it was like, no, this is not I want to hear Joe Coleman blowing himself up. I want to hear those two singers, like really, you know, like, so it was definitely a visual presentation, which was like, you know, the strong case for a lot of bands where like their visual is just so incredible that like try capturing that on record. It's not always the easiest thing to do.
Well, that brings up the other band that I had to ask you about. Well, you know, with Stimulators, you always see the Mad. And, of course, that band, there are some great documents on record of. But, like,
yeah,
the stories from the live performance.
I never saw the Mad.
You never got to see them.
Yeah. I never saw the Met. I remember those guys being around, but I never saw them. You know, when those younger bands first started, the one that I would see a lot was the Blessed, and it with Billy Blessed and who else was in that band? You know what I'm talking about?
No, Blessed.
Walter Lure. Oh yeah, the dude, the Blessed. Walter Lure from the Heartbreakers actually played guitar with them for a little bit, which was always funny because they were so young, and then Walter Lure just sort of looked like grandpa on stage playing guitar. Even though Walter Lure was hardly probably 32 at that point. But and then, you know, that happened a couple of times. I remember when Kraut had like Steve Jones playing guitar with him a couple of times.
Yeah.
It was just like, it was just too weird. Like these young guys, like, yeah, you know, and there would just be like this guy who, like, you know, could barely get out of bed, just getting, oh, yeah, man, I'll show you how to punk out. And it's like, well, no, it's just looked weird. And, the Blessed were the teenage punk band that sort of like were at all, you know, they, that whole front row at CBGB's of all those guys and girls, yeah, or whatever, the bands that came, that they started, there was the Student Teachers and the Blessed. Those were the two like kind of real teenage bands. And there was a couple other ones. There was a band called Spicy Bits who never recorded.
Yeah, no, I never heard of the Spicy Bits either.
Yeah, Spicy Bits, like the singer of Spicy Bits worked the door at CBGB. And these were all sort of young people, like younger than I was almost. And mm-hmm. like, you know, they were starting bands. And I would see them. And I wasn't really a big fan of the Blessed. I thought they were a little, I don't know. I mean, in retrospect, I kind of adore them. But, you know, the drummer from the Student Teachers just wrote a memoir.
Oh, really?
Which is like a punk memoir that's called Girl in the Back. And which I think is pretty good.
Yeah, I got to get that book.
Yeah, The Girl in the Back, A Female Drummer's Life with Bowie, Blondie, and the 70s Rock Scene. It's by, her name is Laura Davis Chanin, Chanin.
Oh, sounds awesome. I definitely got to pick that up.
Yeah, it just came out. Sylvain's book, There's No Bones in Ice Cream,
mm-hmm.
his New York Dolls book.
Yeah.
Man, that's really good.
There's also the, you brought him up earlier, the Gary Valentine book, I think, is an interesting document.
The Gary Valentine book's great.
Yeah, that transitional period you're talking about, too.
Yeah, the Gary Valentine book is really worth reading is for that whole scene. And as is Philip Marquard's book, the guy who's in The Senders.
Oh, I got to get that.
That's really good to read. Duncan Hanna's book called 20th Century Boy. He was like the guy who ran the television fan club in like 76 until Verlaine told him to take a hike. And he was like, he was part of that scene. He was a young art student guy who came into New York really early on. And he designed like the cover of the first Marvels 7-inch.
Oh, know,
like,
that's awesome.
Stuff like that on the Ork.
Yeah.
He's part of the Ork scene. So his book is great because it's all his diaries of the time that he kept. So it's not it's not like a memoir. It's actually sort of his diaries of the time. So it's just like, you know, there's all this stuff's happening in his diaries where he's hanging out with like television and Patti Smith and stuff, that it's really good. There's stuff in there that really kind of elucidates a lot of the scene that you probably wouldn't get from just people trying to remember things.
were you in New York when Sid Vicious showed up?
Oh yeah, totally. I would like when the Pistols didn't play New York.
Yeah.
It was just like so frustrating, and you knew they were like. I was just like, man, do I drive to Atlanta? You know, my good friend Don Fleming, who was in Velvet Monkeys, and, mm-hmm. and you know, he saw them in Atlanta. He said it was great.
Oh, that's awesome! I had no idea he saw them there.
Yeah, yeah. He said that was like really good, and you know, so we were keeping tabs on it. Like, oh, they're in Texas or in Tulsa, you know, and then they do that. They do that kind of shit show in San Francisco, yeah. you know, and then it's over. And then they come to New York after that. And so the thing is, right at the end of that tour, there's an ad in the Village Voice for like Sid Vicious and his crew at Max's Kansas City. And it's right afterwards. And, so yeah, we went to that, you know, me and Harold went to that. When we were like kind of, like smart enough to like go early. Like we were like, we got to go and get in line.
Yeah.
And we did, we got there like like, you know, late afternoon, and there's already a few people like lined up, and we got in line, and we were like, and we just waited like, you know, multiple hours, and then like, you know, clambered upstairs, sat really close, and then sat waiting for like another like 1,000 hours because they didn't really they and there was like this really hellish band that opened up, you know, that was just kind of wrong. And then and then they another like few hours, and then finally like people were just getting super restless and drunk, and it was, and weirdly enough, it wasn't like the typical Max's audience that I would see, like New Yorkers. It was like a lot of French people and like leather pants wearing kind of European, like I was like, what? This is strange. And finally they kind of, and the only way to get to the stage is through the audience at Max's. You'd come down like from the dressing room, and then you would walk through the audience, and you know, it was a small room.
Okay.
And it was tables, you know, it was kind of like, you know, a little bit of a cabaret vibe. So they kind of finally, like, you know, they come on stage, and you're looking at it, it's just like, you know, it's Killer Kane on bass, it's Sid, Nancy's with him holding his hand, and Ty Styx, I think, is on drums, who was like a Heartbreakers drummer guy, and I don't think it was Nolan. It might have been Nolan, and Jerry Nolan on drums. I forget who the drummer was. It's on the record, Sid Sings record. And Mick Jones of The Clash. And The Clash have yet to play New York. They're supposed to play – they're going to play the Palladium, which we have tickets for. We're going to see The Clash. But they have yet to really play. And so there's Mick Jones. And it's like, why is Mick – like, this dude from The Clash, you know, like playing guitar. And so they come out, and there's a curtain on stage. So they come on. People are just, like, ready to lose it. And Sid sort of opens a curtain, just sticks his head out, and does his famous, like, Sid wink, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he's totally playing Sid. He's like, I'm Sid. This is what you want? Yeah, I'm giving it to you. And he does. And then the curtain opens up, and they go right into, like, you know, come on, everybody. Like, cover songs, you know? Like, and he's just like, he's totally like the, you know, the chain bell, the chain, you know, around his neck, you know, the whole thing. And Nancy's like playing a tambourine barely, you know, against her like leg. And like, and the whole place erupts. I mean, it's like every table, every chair is just like upended, you know, it's like, you know, like punk nuts, like nutso. And me and my friend are just like looking at each other laughing, like, what the, like, you know, we're getting killed.
Yeah.
And so the gig is just great. And, you know, after the first song, like some girl yells like, you know, I love you, Sid. And he's just like, shut your fucking mouth, you stupid fucking. You know? And then somebody like spits, and then he just like super gobs back, like right in like the face of the person. Like, he was just totally on it. Like, you know, I am like, this is Sid.
Yeah.
He played for 30 minutes. And it was just like, it was just destruction. It was great. And then I would see, you know, and I think I moved to New York right then. And so I think that's how it was happened. My friend who would see these gigs with me, Harold, never moved. He stayed in Connecticut. So he would meet me, and then we would do these things. And so, yeah, I was living in this tiny little, like, super tiny apartment on 13th between A and B, right across the street from, like, where Lydia Lunch lived. And you know, it's, you know, these kind of no wave people were living around where I was living.
Well, that was the other thing I was going to ask you about. Like, when did you had done The Coachman when you were younger, right?
Yeah, I'm doing that. Like, that's what gets me to move to New York, because I got to be in the band.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And so were you already hip to, like, the no wave stuff that was happening at that time? Or, like, how did you become aware of that?
Oh, I was hip to it in the sense that I knew that it was happening, and I would see these bands, and they were just kind of like, they were really curious to me. I didn't really like evaluate them necessarily. I was just sort of like, well, these are just like local bands that are just playing like really insanely, you know, like it's like, you know, but I was kind of I got more into it, but at, you know, like in 76, 77, like when Lydia's doing Teenage Jesus and the Contortions are happening, I never saw Teenage Jesus at the time because I was just kind of wary of it. And she was really like saying stuff in the Soho Weekly News about like hating everything, like, you know, calling Patti Smith a barefoot hippie, you know, like,
yeah.
And I was just like, whoa, you know, this is like, we're not even past 77 yet where we're kind of disparaging Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin. You're already disparaging like the person who's disparaging the yeah. It's like, well, it's too soon. You know, at least let her do Easter before you start doing it. But so Lydia was just like hardcore from the very beginning. She was, you know, Lydia moved to New York in 74, she saw like, you know, she saw everything. She was a Kiss groupie and she was like, she kind of was a runaway who befriended Wayne County, you know, like in 74. And like, she was just like on the street. It's like, she is the one eyewitness of all eyewitnesses to everything, you know?
Oh yeah.
She's completely quote unquote intimate with the scene. Let me put it that way. And, so her story is like, man, if you can get that story,
I want to
call her and get a punk story. She'll give you a punk history lesson that is insane. Cause she tells me things once in a while that like, that she had that about everybody, about be it like Willie DeVille, anybody I mentioned. If I mentioned Dr. Feelgood, she goes like, oh yeah, that guy. And she'll tell me
she's got a story.
About, like, yeah, like this crazy, like, you know, she's just like on it. You know, like, she takes Teenage Jesus to like London in like 77, you know, with like no announcement. They just go over there on like, you know, scam gigs and stuff. So no, she's hardcore.
Oh yeah, but still doing amazing records. Like that's someone who pushes the envelope.
Yeah, she's still the real deal, man.
Yeah.
But what did you ask me?
Well, no. So you moved to New York with the Coachmen. So where did you guys kind of fit in scene wise? Like, where did you find yourselves playing, or where were you?
Art rock band. I mean, those guys came out of Rhode Island School of Design. They were like the next graduating class after David Byrne and Tina Weymouth and all that. Talking Heads. So that was part of their scene there.
Yeah, okay.
And they were when the Talking Heads were first called the Artistics, and sometimes the Autistics, and they played on campus, and they moved to New York and called themselves Talking Heads.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys came later, and they were, you know, they were the same deal. They were like graphic artists or whatever, and wanting to sort of like pick up guitars. I just met J.D. King, one of the guys, just by chance at Cutler's record store, like at the Velvet Underground bin, you know, and just we started talking about stuff, and he was asking me about like Punk Magazine and all this kind of stuff. I was like, yeah, I knew everything. And so he was like, Jesus. And so he took my number, and then we started writing to each other, and then he said, yeah, we're moving to New York, and we're gonna start bands, blah, 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 and if you want to like come and maybe play bass or something. I was like, yeah, whatever. And so I just started driving in, and like with the cheap guitar I had, and just like kind of met these guys and started playing, and they decided to call the band the Coachmen as a kind of a joke name, you know, thinking that it was like sort of the prototypical kind of lounge rock name of like, you know, it was just a kind of an off name. So those guys were kind of really tied into the whole sort of Talking Heads, David Byrne, art rock world around Soho, playing in, you know, loft spaces and galleries. And that's kind of how I saw like the Static and Theoretical Girls and in these bands, because they were kind of part of that more Soho art rock scene.
So
just sort of knowing, you know, just knowing that these, you know, there was like this kind of a bit of a division between those bands and sort of the East Village bands around Contortions and Mars and DNA. And I would see, I saw DNA and when Robin Crutchfield was in it, and Mars, I would see. Mars started out as China. I remember China playing at CBGB's, but I never saw them. I wish I did. I kind of wish I was hanging out with all these people, because they were kind of they were all in the same places, you know. Mm-hmm. I would see them, but they kind of were crazy. Everybody was like, you know, living on each other's floors and like no money and kind of doing drugs and kind of like doing weird things for money and like whatever. I was kind of like a conservative Catholic Connecticut kid, kind of like, you know, I was kind of watching out for myself a bit. You know, I think if I had gotten a little closer to that crew of like James Chance and Lydia and stuff, I probably wouldn't be talking to you right now.
It was a hard living scene.
Yeah. It was just kind of like, yeah, their bodies kind of fell.
Yeah.
And so I was a little sort of, put off by some of their kind of, you know, they were very sort of like, yeah, they were just so super negative and weird, and like, and I kind of liked it, but I didn't really care. I was just sort of like, you know, we're doing our thing, and you know, it sort of is interconnected, and but we were all at the same gigs. There's a famous photo, like that No Wave photo of everybody sitting on the top of the car outside of CBGB's, like the No Wave like lineup.
Yeah.
But that's my friend Harold, who I go to all the gigs with, sitting at the very far end, just sort of looking kind of bummed out, smoking a cigarette. That's him. That's the guy. And behind him, you see a white Volkswagen parked on Bleecker Street facing the photograph. Mm-hmm. That's my Volkswagen. I'm just off to the side, like also just smoking a cigarette, but I'm not in that photo. And I talked to Godless about it. You know, I said, you know, you just missed me in that photo. I'm so pissed off that I'm not in that photo.
Pull out further. Why did you pull out a little further?
It's like young Sklavunos and like everybody's in that car, you know, Bradley Field and all this stuff. So we were all in the same places. But I was kind of like, you know, your bands are kind of whatever. I mean, they're just kind of they sound crazy, whatever. I never really thought – it wasn't until No New York came out and I was like, hey, this is kind of cool. And then like – and then seeing Glenn play like with the Theoretical Girls and the Static, I really liked what was going on with like this guitar noise and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I did dig it. I did like it, but I never really thought of it as like, this is like, you know, this is really making me want to, you know, really invest in being a musician or something. Not in a sense that like watching like Tom Verlaine or something like that, which I was just really like, you know, that would really sort of take me there. But you know, in retrospect it does, you know, and I think about like seeing like the Static or seeing Glenn's first six guitar thing or whatever, and like how important that was really to like what I began doing, you know, more outside beyond the Coachman and the Sonic Youth and stuff like that.
Absolutely. I was gonna say, like, so you play with the Static, is that when you meet Glenn for the first time, I guess?
Well, I don't play with the Static. I see that the Coachman play on a gig with the Static. It's the first time I see them. Yeah
that's right.
We play it at a some kind of loft party at Jenny Holzer's loft on Broadway. And with the Static were terrible. I mean, I remember they were like, it was Barbara S and Glenn, and they were in they were doing these really kind of long extrapolated kind of songs that were sort of designed to annoy in a way. But you can hear them like on the cassette tape that came out of the Static, like the Static Dan Graham cassette that came out of England when they did it at, you know, they did it here at the South Bank Center or something. It was like some of the art scene. But the Static 7-inch is great, and the Theoretical Girls 7-inch is pretty killer too. So I mean, you know, hearing those records, that's sort of where I connect with Lee, you know, because Lee was really sort of into that scene, and Kim was into that scene as well, but she was kind of coming in it from art world, moving to New York with Mike Kelly, and just kind of like, you know, look, it was definitely art world, where I was like kind of more like music kind of street thing. And Lee was coming out of college, and so he was like, he was in New York to like do art and music and stuff. I wasn't in New York to do art and music. I was in New York to be in a rock band. I was in New York to be in a band. That was my primary thing. The idea of art school, I knew that existed, and that was sort of a defining kind of motivation for a lot of people. But nobody told me about art school. Like, you could actually go to art school and like, you know, do really cool stuff in art school. You know, my father was like an art appreciation professor, you know, but he passed away in 76. So I mean, it was just this thing like, you know, you can actually go to art school and like, you know, be around a bunch of people that, you know, you might sort of, you know, enjoy being around. This never, that never was, that was never an alternative for me. So I just like I just jumped to New York and like hung out with all these art school people.
Yeah.
Everybody, you know, so New York was like, there was very few indigenous people in New York playing New York music, you know, except for like the Harley Flanagans of the city, you know, these kind of street rats. But most people were coming out of like art schools. All the No Wave people were coming out of Cleveland or Florida. You know, Lydia came from Rochester, New York. And
even the Dead Boys.
You know, even the Dead Boys came from Cleveland. Yeah. The Talking Heads came from college.
Yeah.
And you know, Patti Smith came from New Jersey, you know, like in the 60s. And so it's like nobody really would brought up in the streets of New York. That was something that was more part of like the Latino music scene, you know, salsa scene, and the hip hop scene was starting to happening. You know, it was like these were people who were making music that was brought up from their experience of growing up in this environment.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of curious. The hardcore scene was more in a way of like kids who had grown up in the city. So that was kind of interesting. You know, they're at least close to the city, like Heart Attack or whatever came from Long Island, you know. So these guys had a bit more of a affinity to like growing up in the city than most of us from the 70s, you know.
Did you see any of that stuff when that stuff? Well, obviously you saw that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what was that like when that started coming?
I saw that Stimulators at Tier 3. Tier 3 was like a 6-month long club, and that was really great. And that's where I saw more of the kind of just post No Wave bands. Like as soon as they started playing stuff that was less kind of just like skronked out stuff. So like Contortion sort of broke off into like the Bush Tetras.
Mm-hmm.
The Bush Tetras were great when they first started, like, and then Lydia started doing this thing called Eight-Eyed Spy, you know, with different people from different, these bands were all sort of incestuous, and that was, Eight-Eyed Spy were great. And that's where I started seeing those bands. And those bands kind of brought me back to their kind of like, you know, their first bands like Teenage Jesus and stuff like that. But this was all happening like within a year and a half.
It's crazy to think about how compressed this time period.
Yeah. Things are just like flashing. And then like all this stuff from England is like, the Rank Tier 3 and Madness plays at Tier 3 and Certain Ratio plays at Tier 3. And like these things come over and they just play and they go back to London. But yeah, I saw the Stimulators at Tier 3 and they were playing like straight up kind of punk rock.
Yeah.
And at that point, like, it was like, well, nobody's really playing straight up punk rock anymore. I mean, people are playing more weirdo rock and just like just other things going on here. But to play like really straight up kind of like Ramones, Dead Boys, kind of like Buzzcocks, you know, like core stuff, is like in a way that wasn't really happening anymore. So I was a little sort of like, that's funny that they're actually like, that's really what they want to do. So it's a little quaint. You know, even at that time. And so I didn't really think much of it. And, you know, of course, like Harley being this like really young drummer was kind of funny. But there, you know, it was definitely this energy thing. And then I started seeing a lot of flyers for like bands like Even Worse in Heart Attack and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I got kind of interested in, I don't know how I got interested in it. You know, the Rat Cage opened up. And it was a record store, so I would go there because it was a record store. And the Rat Cage sort of had these first 7-inches coming out of DC, like the first like Discord 7-inches, Youth Brigade and SOA and Minor Threat and Teen Idols.
And you were probably like, were you already aware, obviously, of like the stuff that was happening in California at the same time?
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I think maybe that's it may be sort of connected to that because, you know, when I meet Kim in 80, late 79 to 80, and she's Los Angeles. So I go to LA with her, but that's like around, I guess that's in 80. And I go to LA to see her family and stuff. And I really want to go to the Whiskey. And I think it's around this time that I'm really sort of curious about the Germs. I think when Darby dies, Darby dies the same weekend as John Lennon. And I remember, you know, I remember the Lennon murder happening and rehearsing with like Kim and Anda Marinus and Dave Key, who was like drumming with the Coachman at the time. And we were just sort of getting things beginning. I don't think we were even calling ourselves anything yet. And that happens. And then I remember going to this one store that sold like music magazines and stuff called, it was called Same As That in Soho, and they would have Flipside and Slash, and I would look at that going like, oh, this is this whole LA thing. And Search and Destroy, like, and then the English papers and stuff. And so I would get these things. And so I became very curious about the germs just because of the fact that this guy died, you know? And then, and then going to LA and like getting these records, and the Germs record, the first Germs record I got was the one that was Caught in My Eye, 12 inch, that came after the GI record. And that's when I met Michael, and I met Michael Girard, and he had just moved to New York, and he was playing in the Bee People, Strict Dids, and he was friends with Kim from university, Otis Art Institute. So she introduced me to this guy that she went to school with, and it was Michael Girard. And then I had just come back from LA, and I said like, oh, I got these records in a, I think Group Sex was out. Jealous Again. I had these first LA records, but I was really kind of interested in it. And I remember hearing Jealous Again 12 inch and just thinking it just sounded brutal. Yeah. I mean, it just sounded like, yeah. I mean, it just sounded like I couldn't believe that guitar sound. And it was just something, you know, I remember like the people we were staying with or whatever, just looking at me going like, this sounds horrible. Like, you know, so like, I was like, yeah, it sounds, I mean, to me, I was just like, what is this? This is like totally damn, like, and so I remember like playing, meeting Michael Girard, and he was just like, oh, I was totally part of that scene around the mask and all this kind of stuff like that. And like, he's like, how just great it was. Like, you know, he was like, you know, place, it was just like total insanity, like at the mask. And then playing, and I said, well, I got this record Caught in My Eye, but the Germs, you know, Darby died, and I was going to, and remember putting that record on and just like Michael Girard's face going like, this is really what, that's the sound that was like happening in LA. Like that's the sound of that record caught my, that song Caught My Eye by the Germs on that 12 inch is like, to me, is this like number one.
Perfect.
I mean, you know, it's like, Jesus Christ. And so that, I think that's what really led me into super getting into like West Coast punk. Hold on a second. Hello?
I think my favorite Jonah story is like that time we were playing in South by Southwest, and you were doing that show, and Andrew WK no-showed, and Jay hit me up. He's like, who do you know that can play all these songs? And I'm like, Jonah. 100% Jonah.
Yeah, it was like 30 hardcore songs. And he just is like, it's this one, it's this one, it's this one. He's like, oh, yeah. He nailed the whole thing.
He nailed the whole thing. It's
he nailed the whole thing, and he was just like killing it. And I was just like, I'm like reading off lyric sheets. You know? I was like, damn.
Oh, I would be too. I would be reading off the lyric sheets. That's the thing is, Jonah could have filled in for anyone that night and nailed all those songs.
Yeah.
Like, he's just got that kind of like, especially when it comes to punk and hardcore, like a photographic memory. And I really think that, you know, we are in your image, you know, as far as punk music consumers and punk music fans. Like
Maskus has the same thing where he can like just like, because like when I brought on all the songs, he just like he completely nailed each one. He goes, like, oh, you know, I had all those records. I was like, I had all those records too. I can't like just pick up a guitar and play them. But
it's Maskus though. You know, he spares all the social graces in order to retain all the riffs. Whereas with Jonah, I don't know how he does it because he's still like the most personable human being I know.
Right.
And yet retains all the riffs somehow.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
Back to what we were talking about earlier when we were talking, you know, about you kind of like finding this like scene, going to see these bands and the sort of this new scene that's happening. It's almost like you're like one of the few people like, you know, cause you have that zine that came out. That's like a hardcore fanzine, but also talking about, you know, the art scene that you're also got one foot in at the same time. You're one of the few people it looks like that was straddling those lines.
The thing is, I got really into hardcore. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
And it's just like, as soon as I saw the bands, like, I really like, I, The thing is, like, the Misfits were sort of like this kind of core band from that scene. And the Misfits were around pretty early on. Mm-hmm. And the Misfits were kind of this band doing like a horror shtick. They would play at Max's a lot. And I wasn't interested. And then I would hear like, when the Rat Cage first opened and there was like younger hardcore kids hanging out, I remember like hearing a couple of people talking about, the Misfits are playing at Irving Plaza. And there was this famous gig with the Misfits with like Minor Threat and Negative Approach and Necros, I think. And I was like, this is kind of a crazy gig. And I was like, I couldn't go. I think we were going away, like we were going to do touring or something. And I was like, that's one gig I really like to see, like with all these bands I've been hearing about. And, but I remember these hardcore kids at Rat Cage going like, yeah, you know, we're going to leave before the Misfits come on. I don't want to see the stupid Misfits. So either corny, like, you know. And I just sort of thought that was the case, but this certainly wasn't the case for like, you know, like the bands really outside of New York. They were just like, the Misfits were super critical.
Yeah.
And I think as soon as I heard, the Jackie O single, I was just like, this is great. You know, attitude, come on. That's like, you know, that was so good. I was like, I realized like the Misfits are great. Like these records are great. They must be great live. Never got to see them. I never went to see them. And they kind of sort of stopped. I saw Sam Hain as soon as they started, but I didn't see Misfits. But I started going to A7 and seeing, you know, hardcore bands. And so in the New York ones, like Heart Attack, like the Heart Attack 7-inch, I remember Glenn Branca coming from 99 Records, where he was going to do his first record with, mm-hmm. and we used to hang out there, and he was walking down the street. It's like, oh, here's one of those hardcore records that, you know, that you like. And I was like, what? He thought it was weird that I liked, you know, like this music.
Yeah.
And he says like, yeah, these Heart Attack. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. I think I heard about these guys. And that record was Dead, Shotgun, amazing. Just, like, I played that record over. I was just like, this is it. This is like, boom, like we're in. And so I went to see Heart Attack and they were great. And a lot of New York bands were not like Buzzkill, like Buzzsaw is that, you know, like Kraut was like kind of a little more rock, and the Undead and all these, they were, you know, they sort of had this kind of New York thing that was in transition, whereas like the DC bands were like starting like day one, and they were coming up and just like killing it. And CBGB started having hardcore matinees, and those were just super amazing. And that's everybody from all the different, like Connecticut, Vermont, everybody's coming into New York just to go to the matinees. And that's where you started getting like these sick pits, you know, with like all these bands. And I went there every hardcore show I was at, you know, and I was kind of like the older guy standing against the wall, you know. I didn't shave my head. I didn't start like, you know, circle dancing with everybody. I was just like, you know, I would just observe. I knew that I was kind of older and I was like, man, I wish I was like 4 or 5 years younger. I would be so part of that now. But I was in like this band that, as we were walking into the Pyramid Club, like the hardcore kids would go, artsy bands rule, you know, like this kind of thing. I was like, oh man, I felt like a little at odds. So I started infusing more of that into Sonic Youth. So even on like the second record, Fusion of Sex, there's, you know, this like, there's things on there that for me were like kind of a sort of kind of hardcore reference, you know, musically, even though our guitars were tuned completely wrong.
No, absolutely. 100% though. Like you hear that on that record. Like I remember I remember buying that record, you know, after being into Sonic Youth, of course, and being like, oh man, this is way too harsh. And then going back to it once I kind of was more into hardcore and being like, oh shit, I understand this way more now.
Yeah. A lot of it had to do with my love for hardcore at the time, like day one. And it was just like, you know, it was put up with by the rest of the band members more than anything. I took Lee to see a few gigs. You know, Kim was okay with it. But, you know, I was just sort of like making hardcore mixtapes. I was getting all the 7-inches. I was just making like cassette mixtapes of like, you know, I still have my original cassette tape hardcore mix on one side of the label says H, on the other side of the label says C.
I think, is that in that mixtape book that came out years ago?
Yeah. That's it.
I have definitely studied that tape.
That was my kind of like gift tape that I would like dupe for people. I was just way into it. At some point I became friends with Lyle Heisen. I remember like playing a gig at Folk City, just like noisy Sonic Youth drumsticks, screwdrivers, all this kind of stuff. And I remember like Lyle Heisen from the Misguided brought the members of Heart. He brought Jesse Malin from Heart Attack. A couple other people came to see our gig. Mm-hmm. And we were playing, and I think it had a lot to do with us playing with the Meat Puppets, because they had just come to New York for the first time. So it was like Sonic Youth, Meat Puppets, and Hose, which is Rick Rubin's.
Rick Rubin's band, Def Jam 001 and 002.
Yes. And so we did this gig, and those guys came. And I remember, always remember, like, Jesse Malin was like, you know, he was like, he must have been like 4 years old. And he was just going like, oh, man, I heard that you saw the Dead Boys. I was like, yeah, man, I saw the like 500 times. I saw every Dead Boys gig there. But it was just sort of like, it really made me feel old all of a sudden. I was like, I was still in my 20s. All of a sudden, there was like this new generation that wasn't old enough to have seen the Dead Boys.
Yes.
Whoa. Things are changing, you know. And then we did our gig, and I remember them outside going like, hey, you guys got a lot of energy. And I was like, oh, that's
worst thing you can say.
Yeah, but I think that was their way. I mean, that was like, you know, the idea of having a lot of energy was just like, yes, that was a good thing.
Yeah, it's like, oh, the crowd seemed to love it tonight. That's the...
Yeah, the crowd liked it.
The crowd really liked it.
But and then we did a gig with Heart Attack in CBGB's. It was like Heart Attack, Swans, and Sonic Youth at CBGB's.
Oh, what a show!
And then we did a gig with Necros at CBGB's. I became friends with Barry and those guys. I did an interview with like. I was playing with Even Worse, you know, for a little bit.
Yeah,
and
of
we
course.
We were on like a hardcore bill at Great Gildersleeves that was next door to CBGB's club, and it was like Even Worse, Minor Threat, and Cause for Alarm, and and maybe the. What were they called? The Abused.
Whoa!
And
So sick.
So like all the bald head like New York bands. Yeah. And us. And then like, and I interviewed Ian and on cassette, and I put some of it in Killer, my fans in Killer, this interview with Ian in there. And that's how I kind of met like Jimmy Johnson at Forced Exposure. Like I traded zines with him. He's like, I like your interview with Ian. And it kind of like sort of similar to the interview I did with Ian and F.E. And so I started meeting a lot of these guys. I became kind of the interview I did with Ian was on the phone. Actually, he just gave me his phone number at the gig, and he said, "Yeah, call me." You know. And, so I called him, and he gave me like a 5-hour interview. And so I just started, I started getting into all like the whole sort of like scene across America, like the whole Madison scene, you know, like the whole Cleveland scene, the whole Ohio funny punk scene.
Yeah.
You know, like the Beat Offs and the Offbeats and like Starvation Army. Starvation Army I thought were great.
Great band, yeah.
Yeah. And I saw them, they came to New York, and I was just like, yeah, Starvation Army. And Starvation Army did a cover of that song from Chips, you know. And,
what's the punk band in that movie, in that episode called? Fuck.
Yeah.
I know exactly.
Yeah, they do a cover of that song, but Harley's band also did a cover of that song. And I remember like Starvation Army doing a cover of that song really well.
Yeah.
And and I remember these hardcore kids turning around and looking at Harley like, whoa, dude, you don't own that anymore. And like, and Harley had this look of on his face like, oh shit, you know, just,
That's awesome. Well, speaking of covers, I had to bring up the fact that you brought up that mistake that's on Louie way back when we first started talking. And then when you guys did that cover of Crime Sister and you included the mistake on it. That to me is like that song is uncoverable because you guys did the perfect cover version.
That's nice of you to say that.
You know, like you guys kind of own that song. But it's also like, you know, it's also funny that like, you know, you brought up Barry Hensler, you brought up all these people, like they would eventually do bands that kind of like went artier. It's like everyone eventually catches up to you.
Well, I don't know.
Or you guys, your band.
I think, you know, it's sort of like in the no wave thing. It's like bands just like they kind of you can't help but sort of like kind of like find your way around the keyboard in a way. You know,
yeah.
It's like I certainly did that. Like even when Sonic Youth did Daydream Nation again, like in the early 2000s, as like a bit of a retro thing, I was really up against it because I didn't want to return it anything. But it was just like listening to the master tapes of Daydream Nation and hearing my guitar channel sort of, you know, just by itself. I was like, God, I played so differently, so simply. Like, you know, it was like, throughout the 90s, I just sort of became a different guitar player because I just, you play so much and you just start becoming more, you know, you just become more adept. And so I think that's sort of what happened with our hardcore bands. They started becoming bands that had a more musicality to them, for better or worse.
Mm-hmm.
I think it had a lot of the hardcore kids too. I mean, certainly with Minor Threat sort of like hitting a wall and then Ian going into doing Fugazi and stuff like that, you know, or even like Rollins leaving Black Flag and doing Rollins Band, where it became more kind of different fusion-y ideas and stuff. Anybody.
Even Black Flag by that point, right? Like even Black Flag had changed so much by that point.
Yeah. And Flag was always like, Flag was all about change.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, in the face of just expectations of just like, you know, that band was super interesting in that respect, again, for better or worse. You know?
Yeah, exactly. I think, like, you know, you bring up Daydream Nation, but to me, Sister, that's the record that I think is like the perfect bridge between kind of like what would become and, you know, sonically like alternative music and then what was before.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like I think that record to me is like, you know, right down to the Crime cover being on there.
That's right. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know, what year is that? That's like 87.
Yeah.
You know, then covering a Crime thing is just sort of like, I mean, you know, that Crime 7-inch is from when? Like 78, 79 or something?
78,
like
that. I think that one.
It's already, you know, it's a good decade, and so it's becoming this kind of like, you know. But the thing with that is like trying to find that Crime single,
oh, yeah.
You know, was impossible.
Bootleg.
Yeah, I mean, finding... you know, those original documents from like California, like, you know, like I found the first Alley Cat 7-inch. I mean, it was like, that was big,
yeah.
You know, to find these records, you know, like hiding somewhere in a record store. You know, if you found the Eddie and the Subtitles 7-inch, you were just like, whoa, or like somebody had like the gold vinyl Adolescence 7-inch. It was just like finding like, you know, Medusa's tooth. Or
When did you start buying records from, like, 'cause I remember reading, I think it was in Magnet, you had a column or I can't remember which magazine, but you did an article about Finnish hardcore one time.
Oh, and wow. Yeah. That might've been in, there was a magazine called Mean, that the writer Dave Eggers kind of like edited. I was kind of in there for a second. Like I had some column called, The Living Underground.
I'm trying to remember. I think it was like more of like a, just sort of like, it might not have been Magnet, not Mix Mag. It was like a fairly available magazine. And I remember like distinctly you had like, and it might not have been, I'm pretty sure it was
Finnish.
I don't
even remember that. I mean, I totally would have. And I probably did, you know, according to you.
No, it had an impact on me seeing you write this in, especially like, you know, once again, like, you know, I was by this point, like, you know, these were the bands I was obsessed with. And here, once again, you were writing about these bands in a mainstream
place. Finnish hardcore 7-inch, those first Finnish hardcore 7-inches were just crazy how great they were.
Yeah.
You know, Bastard, I mean, first Turvi Cadet, Chaos. I met the singer from Chaos like years later. The guy was like in and out of prison a few times. You know, he was just like, whatever, like in Finland. And then he came to like some sound check or something. What's his name? Jackie or something.
Yeah.
The singer of Chaos. And I was just like, dude, you are like, you know, so important. Like to me, he was just like, you know, he was in tears. And I was just like, seriously, man, Chaos, those first 7-inches. And the fact that those 7-inches came in like these kind of sleeves that were kind of somewhat opaque in a way, you know,
yeah.
Like, I was like, what is this? Like, it was so mysterious and strange. And each one just like, you know, 7, 8, 9 second songs that were just like fantastic, you know, like, like super hardcore, just like really thin buzzing, like, man, So well, good.
And you did that like in Toronto too. I remember, you know, I wasn't at the gig, but when you guys played the Great Hall, you shouted out like wanting to meet Steve Leckie. Like, it seems like you were the guy that kind of championed a lot of this stuff. You know, especially given the platform you had when no one was championing it, and like, you know, and turning these people that at the time were kind of forgotten into icons.
I was always like into, and it wasn't just like record collecting. I was just like really into the music. And it's like, I have yet to see like a documentary about hardcore, and there has been a couple, mm-hmm. you know, there's been a few where it actually talks about like how good the songs are.
Yeah.
So it's always like, even like that one, like hardcore, you know, we were like, we just wanted to go out and like, you know, mess things up, man. Like, we were just like, whatever. It's just like, there's all this kind of bully boy kind of you know, stuff. And it's like, actually, you know, there's like, hardcore was like being made by like the smart kids, you know, it was like mm-hmm. the smart kids in school were coming out. There was a lot of sort of like, it was open to anybody. It was like, it was a completely open forum. And that was, it was a super, like super democracy, you know, it was like anybody can do this. And it's, but it's about being kind of like conscientious. It's about like, you know, being responsible to like your friends and yourself. And it's not about getting like effed up, you know, I thought that was really good. And it's like, but if you want to get effed up, who cares? Go ahead. You know, do it, you know,
yeah.
Be that. And it's like, whatever. But hardcore was like, you know, it's like what D Boone said about punk rock, like punk rock's whatever we wanted it to be, you know? So that's sort of what hardcore was an extension of, but it was just like for people like, you know, who had really strong voices in hardcore, specifically somebody like Ian MacKaye to be always talking the way he did. I thought that was really cool. I was just like, this is really good. This is like, this is offering a real good alternative, and you can do whatever you want with it. You're still young, whatever. And it's like, that to me was like such a strong voice. And that's hardly ever talked about besides all the other kind of buffoonery and also the song. So in like these hardcore documentaries, it's like, play people like how great those songs are. Play In My Eyes. In My Eyes is like a masterpiece, you know, play that song, you know, this is like, play Rise Above, play whatever. It's just like, there's like this songwriting in the hardcore is just like, there's so many good songs.
I wonder if Ian could even see that.
Like, that's what it's about. It's not about just sort of like, you know, it's not just about the attitude or whatever, the ideology or whatever. It's like, to me, it had to have really good music, had to have really good songs. All those first Discord 7-inches. Yeah, those Youth Brigade tracks on Flex Your Head.
Incredible.
You know, incredible.
But I think
that's why we did that band, Demolished Thoughts band at South by Southwest. It was all about that. It was all about like, okay, we're like older guys now, but this is what we grew up with. And this, and I just wanted to like, this is a catalog of songs that I think are super good, you know, and that's what it was.
But I think like you're one of the few people that like, you know, I don't even think Ian would acknowledge how good, like he will, like obviously, but like, it's not like he was going around in Fugazi being like, yo, can someone introduce me to Steve Leckie? You know, the vile, like shouting out the vile tones on stage, you know, like you were the guy that was doing that, you know, and like, in all respect to Ian, because obviously he's a really smart guy and an incredible voice, you know, and like, you know, an amazing person to punish about music too. But like at the same time, like you're the guy that's going out championing like random Finnish hardcore bands, like, you know, you're the guy that was kind of like giving this place a platform.
There was a band that did a 7-inch in Seattle called Soldier, S-O-L-G-E-R.
Yes. Yes.
Like, it's like, that's the, and man, that was such a hard to find 7-inch. And I remember like doing a Sonic Youth gig, like in Seattle. And that was just like that. I had to sort of call it out. I was like, does anybody here have the Soldier 7-inch? There's like super no response from the audience. It's like a month later, it arrives in the mail.
That's awesome.
Some kid. He's like, I was at that concert. Yeah, you know, it's like, I know those guys. I had, you know, I have a couple copies of that record. And, you know, here you go. And I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. That was awesome.
That's awesome. Do you have that kid's address still?
I probably do.
Okay, let's send him some emails.
I remember being on tour in Australia, and Roland's band was like playing a lot of gigs with us in the 90s. And he was like, because Roland's a big record collector, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
And so I remember him sitting on the stairwell like at some venue, and like he was his first Boys Next Door 7-inch. was like, dude, where'd you get that? You know, that's like, you know, super nugget from like, you know, pre-birthday party, like yeah. Australia. First pressing. You
the
know,
gig only 7-inch? Like, or...
Yeah, yeah. I said, yeah, exactly. I was like, where'd you get that? He's like, I don't know, some kid just gave it to me. He knew I was into it. I was like, all right, man. Well, you know, like.
Says the guy who got a Soldier 7-inch in the mail.
Lucky day. Lucky. Yeah. Well, I got a Soldier 7-inch in the mail.
Thurston, I've kept you for an incredibly long time, and I would just want to impose upon you that one day, would you come back and do a part two?
Yeah, totally, man.
Because we barely scratched the surface. Like, I haven't even brought up the awkward time okay. when I first met you. So,
okay, yeah, we got to go. We got to do that. So, yeah, let's do part two.
Thank you so much, man, for coming on the show.
Thanks, Damien.
Thank you, Thurston, for coming on the show. And you can hear right there, we got room. We got room for an entire spinoff podcast just with Thurston Moore. I could talk to him for like 12 more parts just about the Fast and the Steel Tips. Oh my gosh. Oh, got to get a lot of bands talked about that I've wanted to talk about on this podcast for a while. We're going to have a good episode of Footnotes coming up. Footnotes, of course, the other podcast where we analyze each of these Turn It to Punk episodes hosted by myself and Chris O'Toole. We got a lot to get into this week with this Thurston Moore thing. Oh my gosh. Oh, thank you again to Matthew O'Donohue, Omnibus Press, a Static Piece Library. They got a lot of great books out there on that company. You know, I'm just reading the damn book they put out. There's so many books. So many books. I think they actually even put out the New Wave Encyclopedia Volume 2 way back when in 1982, which is really what I have to credit for knowing about all these weird, obscure, nerdy bands. I would just sit there and read that thing. That thing was like the Bible to me. So once again, Omnibus Press, thank you so much for making that happen. And Tristan, and Matthew again, and everybody, everywhere, thank you very much. Next week on the show, John Jughead Pearson of the band Screeching Weasel. So that is next week on the program. It's going to be a great episode. You know, we're covering everything here at Turn It to Punk. We're covering all the offshoot genres that came out of punk rock. And so we'll have lots more great guests in the near future. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Go out there and make your own culture. Anyone can do this. Gosh, I love this episode. All right. Thank you. Love ya. See ya next week. Oh, and sign your organ donor cards, please. Please. See you next week.